Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for the week of April 30th. It's Golden Week in Japan. What's happening, Jim Allen? How you doing?
Well, Golden Week. I'm here in my golden years, and I think I don't want a week. I want a whole year. I'm not happy with a week. Of course, I'm not happy with a week is I don't get any days off hardly.
Well, you know, we're not that far apart in age, so I'm not going to say golden years or anything. I'm not going to comment on that and say, hey, man, every day is gold. But my friend likes to call this very big vacation time in Japan, and she likes to call it silver days because they're choppy. You know, sometimes you have to go to work in the middle of the week and work a couple days, and then the rest of the week you're off. So she calls it silver days, not golden week.
Okay.
That's her joke, not mine.
I feel like we should have
responsibility for it.
Okay. Well, I wish you hadn't started this whole topic because I have David Bowie's song now running through my head and I can't get it out.
So that's my fault. I wrote the song too then. All right. Well, I'll take responsibility for all the problems. that's part of my job. All right, on this week's show, we've got a chat with Neil Wagner of the Lions. We're going to talk about Seibu. We're going to have our first mini-track segment, talk about the passing of Sachio Kinugasa, and handle some high heat. Man, the bases are loaded. Let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases!
I know we need more bases than four, but...
Yeah.
Okay, I was at MetLife Dome on Saturday morning still, before their day game against
still known as Seibu Kyujo Mae on the train line.
Well, yeah, because changing stadium names is really hard in Japan.
Well, they could have at least changed it to Seibu Dome when they made
no the that's
change.
A lot of trouble. That's a lot of trouble.
I'm saying at least, you know, that's
a lot of pit tape.
a lot of red tape. Okay, well, it is their own train line. You'd think they could do it, but
yeah, it's not that easy. I've learned. Okay, and I'd tell you how I learned that, but it's typically longer story than it needs to be. Anyway, so went out to MetLife Dome, and talked to a few people, including new Seibu Lions reliever Neil Wagner. Now, prior to Saturday's game, Wagner had pitched in 8 games for the Lions. He was 1-0. He had walked 5 batters in 7 3rd innings. He hadn't allowed a home run. You know, nothing special or exciting. But, you know, I just wanted to say hi and, you know, and see what he was up to and how things were going with him. And he told me some stories and about him in Japan and so on. And he before he came to the Lions, he was with the Tampa Bay Rays. Mm-hmm. Had tried to come to Japan for a few times. He'd had teammates who told him about, you know, what to expect in Japan and so on. And he was about to do a deal that was going to send, there was about to be a deal that was going to send him to the Hanshin Tigers, he said, but I believe the team he was with then was the Toronto Blue Jays and they wanted $1 million.
Oh, yikes. Yeah.
And that was that. But, you know, $1 million is not a big deal for a player moving from America to Japan. But it was in that case. So that didn't happen. Now, after that, he had Tommy John surgery in 2014. And then after he came back from Tommy John surgery at the end of 2015, he chipped a bone in his elbow.
Ouch.
Yeah. And he said he needed a two and a half inch screw put into it. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So really good. Yeah, exactly.
I actually know what that's like because my father did the same thing. He broke his elbow in a car accident, and boy, they had two screws or pins put in his arm, and then broke it again doing rehab. So that can be that can be really, really painful and a long timetable for a return. That's awful.
Now, as it so happens, I was talking just minutes after I interviewed him, I was talking with somebody who knew him from their time in the Devil Rays, and he said that
when the Devil Rays when he was there
then, when
before the change.
Excuse me, the Rays when he was in Tampa Bay. I apologize. Oh. I'm in my golden years. Cut me some slack, I'm just Jack. Not sure. So anyway, so when he was with the Tampa Bay Rays, this fella knew him, and he said, "Yeah, he had a plus fastball coming out of college in North Dakota."
Right.
But really nothing else. And so anyway, so we talked about pitches and we talked about Japan and we talked about a few other things. And I really enjoyed this guy's conversation. He's very articulate and it's just good fun. So let's have a listen to Neil Wagner of the Cebu Lions. All right, our guest this week on the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast is Neil Wagner, first-year foreign player with the Cebu Lions. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to be here.
Oh, yeah, I'll bet you are. So you're getting some playing time, and we see you're basically in middle relief. And is that more or less how you expected?
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of started out in middle relief. Now I've gotten some, you know, they've discussed with me having me throw more high-leverage innings. It's just we haven't had a lot of high-leverage innings because we've been scoring 10, 12 runs a game, you know, for the last couple of weeks here.
Yeah, it's kind of a tough situation to be. I guess, you know, and I say that a little tongue-in-cheek, but if you're a reliever, when you're scoring two, you can score too many runs. It kind of upsets the rhythm out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's as a reliever, you like to pitch regularly, but you rarely have that luxury. You either pitch, you know, you're pitching in bunches, or you're, you know, tend to have long layoffs. It's just kind of the way of it, you know. And I've been around long enough to have kind of figured out what I need to do for the most part to get through some of the dry spells here.
Okay. Now you had Tommy John surgery in 2014, and now when you came back and you had another procedure. Now after. How does your arm feel compared to how it felt before? Do you feel like you're pitching with a different? I've heard people have told me it felt like I'm pitching with a different person's arm.
Early on in 2016, when I was coming back off of, you know, almost 2 years of a layoff, it definitely felt weird. You know, sometimes it would, you know, show up and be like, man, it just feels totally normal. Then some days I would, you know, feel like I was looking at my hand and being like, how did I used to hold the baseball, you know, and okay. Stuff like that. But by the end of 2016, I felt I had settled in pretty well, I think. So I'm feeling pretty good now.
Okay. Now you said coming to Japan was not a sudden spur of the moment thing. It had been on your mind for several years. Now, let me ask, what was when the first time you heard playing in Japan, what, like 5-6 years ago or something, what were your thoughts about that?
I mean, I knew a little bit about it because I'd played with some guys, especially at the time that, you know, the possibility of coming over here was being discussed, that had played over here. And so, I mean, I had a pretty good idea of it as being a, you know, a highly competitive league and, you know, with crazy fans and just, you know, it really at that point, even though I hadn't considered it much up to that stage, it sort of at that point when that deal fell through, kind of became one of those like career goals I wanted to have. Oh. It's just, you know, however else everything played out, I just thought it would be a cool, you know, life experience to have. And so I'm glad it's worked out that I've been able to come over.
Okay. Now, I want to ask, well, first, before I get off the subject of Japanese baseball, have there been things, obviously you had a lot of background information, but, you know, that's the thing about background information, you kind of imagine it, and then when you get here and it's real, how has some of that played out? I mean, have you had some surprises? This is what they meant. This is it. I see. Or, that's nothing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that the good advice I got before I came over here was that, you know, there are some things that are different that are better, some that are no better or worse, they're just different, but it doesn't matter, they're different and they're not going to change, you know, they haven't changed for 50 years, they're not going to change for you. So just just adapt to it and that'll help. And that has helped. But I mean, I don't know, like the mounds are a little different, the balls are a little different. Yep. Just sort of the game day routine's a little different. And so it took the first couple of weeks of the season, it took me some time to settle into it, but I feel like I've made the adjustment now. And so, yeah, it took a little time.
So a lot of that's just automatic now. You're used to the mound. You're used to every ballpark's mounds being a little different.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Well, let me ask now, before I get back to Japan stuff. Now, as a pitcher,
how have you evolved as a pitcher? Because you didn't get to this age in your life, you know, being the same guy you were as an amateur. So when you turned pro, what were your basic pitches and how would you describe yourself?
Right. When I turned pro, I came out of, you know, North Dakota State University, wow, which is a small school, and I had big fastball, but I mean there wasn't much else that I needed to, mm-hmm, be competitive there.
Okay.
And so I mean I had a changeup, I had a curveball, but they weren't, you know, they were not, you know, pro caliber pitches. So, I mean, the first few years of my career were largely just figuring out what, you know, what other pitches sort of went in my arsenal.
Okay.
And so, you know, I now have a slider, I have a split finger. And so those, you know, and then it's kind of just been refining, you know, my fastball control. And then the last couple of years with the Rays are big on, you know, the spin rate and pitching up in the zone and stuff. And now the major league pitching coach there, Kyle Snyder, was the AAA guy for the last 2 years.
Okay.
And he was great about sort of translating some of that stuff where it's like, where it's like, look, down, you know, throwing the ball down and away will always have value, but, you know, your best stuff, your best fastball is up in the zone, you know, where it plays better, and then your split finger especially plays better off of that. So, you know, the last couple of years have been sort of, you know, adapting to that pitching style a bit has been the primary adjustment for me.
Okay, now then when you come to Japan, it's not, I don't want to say like it's all out the window, but, you know, the ball doesn't behave the way you imagine it will.
Right. Well, part of the thing too is that the breaking ball is just such a bigger thing here.
Mm-hmm.
And because, I mean, it seems at least, I mean, it's still early for me, but like, you know, the hitters here see, you know, they look up and they see, you know, reasonable velocity on the thing, and they are just dead red on the fastball. And so if you don't have something to get them off of that, you know, then I mean you're really in trouble. In the U.S. the game is a little bit more fastball centric, so
right,
you can get away with just pitching off your fastball a bit more.
Right.
So
anything off the fastball,
yeah,
is good.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like the importance of not just having off-speed stuff to,
right,
show people,
right,
but to like throw it for strikes,
right,
behind in the count and stuff has been just so much more important here.
Yeah, the coaches, I know they tend to look at the foreign pitcher as well. Nice fastball, but
yeah,
do you know how to pitch?
Yeah,
or have you ever thrown a baseball before?
Right. Yeah, and you know it's some of it too is that, you know, like sometimes, I mean, I'm fortunate we have really good catchers here,
mm-hmm,
and they've been, you know, I've communicated with them about how I want to pitch in certain situations, what they think about hitters in certain situations. But, you know, there's also a bit of a feeling out process there too, because, you know, in the U.S. I can just casually walk by the catcher and exchange a couple comments about like, oh, well, maybe next time this and that. Whereas here you have to make a point of like, I'm going to get the interpreter and we'll sit down and talk about it, because,
wow,
you know, because it's just, you know, it's not, you know, I mean, it's not hard or impossible. It just takes you putting in the effort to make it happen. It
takes more effort.
Yeah.
To do something reasonably,
right,
simple.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, of course, the other bit is the translation to the game, because,
right,
you're looking at a game. You're still new looking at the game and the hitters.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is just so much more bunting and running and slashing and stuff here. And it's just one of the things, I mean, to illustrate kind of one of the differences in the game, like in the U.S., basically stealing has become almost a non-existent part of the game for the most part.
Right.
It's just so much more diminished. And
right,
whereas here it's so much more. So like in the U.S., I mean, I hadn't really slide stepped in probably five plus years, because our coaches were like, as long as you're relatively quick to the plate, just pitch and it'll our catcher will throw them out.
No.
And here is just not how it works.
No.
You have to. So, I mean, I've, you know, early in the, like towards the middle of spring training and early part of the season, I've been going back to, you know, A-ball basics and working on slide step stuff.
Yeah,
so,
pretty much another one where they say, you know, no slide step, you know, where the farm team practices,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's, I mean, like I said, that to pitching is kind of like bunting is to hitters, where like,
right,
anyone can do it with enough practice, but if you haven't practiced it in a while, it takes you a little while to,
right,
adjust.
Okay. Well, I don't want to take anything away from the guys who can really bunt here,
yeah,
because it's something to watch.
Yeah.
And obviously when you it's obviously one of the things that you can't really get a feel. You don't feel it in your skin until you actually see these guys bunting all the time.
Right. Yeah, and yeah, it's the degree, the, I mean, the bat handling and sort of the, yeah, the base running. I mean, it's incredible how much better it is here in that regard, because it's just not a utilized skill in the U.S.
Yeah, I think you know, it's not that there aren't people who can't do it over there,
right?
But it's not like the median player can't do it over there, and here the median can.
Yeah,
you know, the guy in the middle.
Yeah, in the U.S. there are some guys who are like, you know, bunt, run, steal guys, but here it's almost everybody, you know.
I would think half the people on your lineup can. So, so what do you, you've been, now, this is a question I ask, but I always get the same answer. So we'll just sort of test my theory here. How's the team atmosphere here?
The team, it's been pretty good. I mean, like I said, it takes a little time to sort of feel guys out when there's a bit of a language barrier,
okay.
but at the end of the day, I mean, it's still a clubhouse atmosphere, still, you know. And, you know, it settled in pretty well. I mean, it's, you know, I think, like, just making a show of trying to adapt to the culture somewhat is something that guys really appreciate. And that helps a lot, too,
right.
I think. So, yeah, guys have been great. It's, I mean, also, it really helps that we're winning a lot. I mean, that'll help any clubhouse
atmosphere. That does,
you know,
help people get along.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. I wish you the best of luck this year with, you know, whatever you learn in Japan.
Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again. It was a real pleasure meeting you, a real pleasure having a chance to talk, and hopefully we'll get many more opportunities over the next few years.
Certainly. I will see you soon, Neil. I'll be going out to Cebu, or whatever we want to call it, MetLife, Cebu, Kyujo Maya, or whatever you want to call it. I'll be out there. I'll be on the train.
The ballpark, the dome formerly known as Prince. Yep.
And since it's so close, too, so that helps me. But, yeah, looking forward to meeting you.
So, I don't know, anything of interest to you?
Of course. And I liked your high heat comment during the question phase where you said, you know, nice fastball, but have you ever thrown a baseball before? I thought that was pretty interesting because you're supposed to be asking a question, but you're throwing high heat.
Well, I was making light of, you know, or not making light, but sort of be a little satire about the way Japanese coaches are.
It was nice. Yeah.
You know?
It was nice.
But he was right on it.
Two impressions, you know, first of all. One is, remember I talked to Frank Herman of the Eagles last season.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Harvard grad, so it was the first time I had talked to a baseball player from an Ivy League school. And then I remember Chris Carter, who played with the Lions back in the early teens, I guess 2012 maybe.
Yeah, sure.
And he was a Stanford grad, so really smart guys, really intelligent guys, really good baseball guys in that part. And you start, from the first moments you hear his voice and how he explains and breaks down things, you can tell he's a really intelligent guy, really smart guy. And I've always said, I was always analytical on the basketball court, and I was always trying to think my way through. And I at some point, one of my friends came up and said, "Look, Mr. Smarty Pants, you can't think the ball into the basket. You know, you got to be able to shoot. You got to be able to play." So these really smart guys out there, it's good to know that they're thinking their way through the game. And he's actually, I saw him pitch today. He got four outs today in Saturday's game. We're taping on Saturday night, by the way, late Saturday night. So he looked good. But you asked him about the clubhouse and testing a theory, but you didn't tell us what your theory was and what the answer was.
Right. I didn't want to tell him that he failed the test.
Yeah, I wanted to know what it was, first of all. That was my first question.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, whenever you ask somebody, how's the team atmosphere, nine times out of 10, the answer I get, I've never been on such a good team.
Okay.
You know, I've never been on such a great clubhouse. And then, you know, people say that, but then they say, oh, and I says, okay, well, name some other clubhouses that weren't so good. And they go, because they really don't know it, you know, they're just saying something. So his was probably the best answer I've ever heard, which was, oh, it's good in this respect and it's good in that respect. And I thought, you know, my theory is everybody just answers the question with the dumb answer.
Oh, I see. All right. All right, so yeah.
So he kind of, he disproved my theory.
All right. So the biggest thing in the interview for me was him saying that he hadn't used a slide step in 5 years. That's insane. Mm. That's insane to me because
that's interesting. Because
we hear these announcers on TV. I, of course, everyone knows who's listened to the show for a long time. I in the mornings I have MLB games on, and then at night I've got MPB games on. So I listen to a lot of announcers, and you hear these guys talk, or and color analysts. I like to listen to the analysts and what they're talking about, and what they're focused on, and you know the difference between guys who are former hitters and guys who are former pitchers, and what they're saying as opposed to the catchers, you know, who used to run the whole show. And the guys always talk about the slide step, this and this guy's quick to the plate, and blah blah blah. And here we got a guy who's talking about not using it in 5 years and having to go back to things he was learning in A ball so that he can figure out how to do a slide step correctly and get the ball to the plate or whatever. And, you know, it all seemed to me one of the reasons why a lot of, I guess, evaluators and scouts were saying, well, we don't think Shohei Ohtani can pitch and hit, because they don't think a pitcher can do a slide step and get a guy out. So he can't do those two things at the same time. Why would they think a guy could do all that and hit too?
Well, that really interested me because, you know, we talked about the not really the skill set of Japan versus the skill set of major leagues, because essentially the skill sets are identical. Right. Except they're not where they're not identical is in, they're sort of like gene pools in a sense that they vary in the proportion of, you know, the properties. You know, there are fewer players, you know, I use that expression median, you know, so is the median, right. Probably the median player in Japan is a pretty good bunter, and you know, in an MLB he ain't,
right. Bunt? Is okay. That the bunt sign, coach? And that's when they drop the bat and leave it at the plate and go and talk to the third base coach.
That's excuse right. Me. Time out. Yeah.
You want me to do what? Is that the bunt sign? Can you do it for me?
Okay, hold on. Can you spell that? So but I was reading something on Bill James online and about where somebody was talking about how one of the things is how stolen bases are disappearing in the majors. And it's basically we don't know exactly why, but it seems likely a byproduct of the number of home runs. You know, the with the frequency of home runs, the cost of a stolen base goes up. So if you're really not good at it, don't do it.
Well, yeah.
People are aware of that.
I would say the cost of the stolen base goes down because if you get caught stealing, then that's a possible run that comes off the board if somebody hits a home run. So I don't know. I guess there's a...
No, that's the cost of the cost of adopting a stolen base is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. The stolen base is a one-run strategy, right? So because you increase the chance of scoring one run at the cost of scoring many because you run into outs.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. So yeah, again, I'm focused on if you get thrown out, then you're not on the base when the home run happens. So
that's why the cost of trying to steal bases goes up. The cost goes up.
I got you.
Okay. So I was interested to hear somebody actually say the stolen base is like gone. You know, it's history.
Yeah,
and that was more extreme than I expected.
Or what he said, you know, to me, I it's like there are a certain number of guys who are going to be stealing, and you know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And like when Billy Hamilton comes up to the plate, he's like, let's not walk this guy. Let's make him earn his way on base because we know he's going to be stealing,
and he can't earn his way on base hardly. So let's do that.
You know, let's try to limit that that part of the game. And then if he gets on base, we know he's going to steal anyway. Don't worry about it. Just be quick to the plate, see what the catcher can do.
Yeah, exactly. You know, do what you're good at. And that's not a surprise to me because that's almost an extension of everything in MLB, which is you do what you're good at and don't make yourself much worse by trying to do something you're not good at.
And then the other thing.
Does that make any
sense? Well, I mean, it does and it doesn't. For us, we've been watching NPB for so long, and they value every base so much, and even enough to sacrifice two outs in an inning to get a leadoff runner over to second or even third. That's how much they value a base.
Yeah. Well,
and a run.
Well, my point was, if the slide step makes you less effective, don't do it. You know, because you've got to be effective in the broad term. It's like bringing a left-handed hitter, to face a right-handed pitcher who's a much poorer hitter than the guy you had at the plate.
Right.
And you're only doing it because of the handedness of the hitter and pitcher, when you're ignoring the fact that the guy, the right-handed hitter at the plate's a vastly better hitter, and it probably has a better chance of hitting the right-hander. Right. So, it's one of those things. You don't shoot yourself in the foot, for a theory.
You hope they don't, but yeah. Other thing that caught my ear was the notion that the guys in the States throw their secondary pitches as a means to an end, but the NPB pitchers try to perfect the craft. And
I think that's I think that's an exaggeration.
It's
a generalization.
Yeah, a lot of guys. It just sounded like he was saying in what Neil was saying in his talk. Yeah, he could overpower guys with the fastball, so he just needed a couple pitches here and there to throw to keep the timing off. And then,
well, I think, yeah, absolutely, because you have to understand, as I mentioned, the guy, somebody told me, yeah, he had a really good fastball. So that other stuff was just window dressing. It was there to support the fastball. And then when you come to Japan, and the thinking is, that ain't gonna work, because the coaches here are just used. Well, first of all, the coaches here believe, I don't know this is true, but I suspect it is true, that everybody can throw a good breaking pitch. They believe everybody can throw a breaking pitch for a strike. If you're is good enough to be here on the mound, and I the Scott Matheson one where they basically, changed the grip on his slider, and his slider became as good as his fastball when they basically hired him as a fastball-only pitcher. Right. And, pitchers pick up extra pitches here. They learn to use them in different combinations and in different ways. Of course, the ball and everything else going on. But obviously, I think with Neil, his oversimplification is coming from the fact that he was primarily a fastball pitcher. I think if you asked, somebody who's trying to be the next Greg Maddux, it's great to have that heavy sinking fastball, but if you don't have the control, the sharp control with your breaking balls, you're never going to be, nobody's ever going to think you're the poor man's Greg Maddux. Yeah.
And I mean, what I was thinking is that the way I phrased it, like I did, in that the NPB pitchers try to perfect the craft, is that I think Yusei Kikuchi was a good example. He had the frontline fastball, but his secondary stuff was never, in my opinion, the first five, 6 years, never good enough to keep guys off the fastball. And when he had to throw it, and they knew that he was going to throw it, they were able to punish him. Not all the time, but enough so that he was not a great 10-game winner for a long time. But in the past couple of years, he has been able to throw those curveballs and command them, so to either make them look like strikes and then have them come out of the strike zone, or to get strikes with them. Called strikes, so that he's got guys off balance so that he can go to either one when he needs to. And that has pushed him over the top, in my opinion. So, and that's why I said it the way I said it, is because in the States, it just seems like a means to an end. We've got to be able to throw our fastball and have them looking for something else, or throw a breaking pitch or a secondary pitch in a certain situation so that we can get a ground ball. But the focus of what we're trying to do is get that fastball and locate that. And so that it's not the biggest, secondary pitches are just a means to an end.
Yep. I'm with you, and again, I think it depends. His standpoint is a little different from many people's, but yeah, I think that's essentially true. Is there's a shift there. The Japanese pitchers, pitching coaches, and battery coaches expect a certain level of proficiency with secondary pitches that in America is not. It's a case by case. Mm-hmm. You're good enough to get by with this. You're not good enough. If you're not good enough, then you have to be, you know, you have to be better. I don't think it's a case of, well, everybody just throws a fastball, because there are guys whose best pitch is not their fastball.
Okay.
So anyway, so moving on.
Okay.
I guess the interesting thing, or the theme of when I was at the ballpark yesterday, was talking about how to adjust mm-hmm. to the varying conditions, you know, because the mounds are all different and from park to park, and you know, everything's different and changing, things you expect and whatnot. And it takes a while to, you know, he said, I'm settling into those. He's settling in, and I thought that was kind of interesting. And I talked to somebody, another Lions player, and he talked about internalizing those kind of little things, that just playing every day helps, playing a lot in the spring helps, and that he's able to move on to like adjustments at a higher level. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, you get I got the sense from him that basically he's ready to take the next step, which is, you know, that when he goes to the mound, you know, and he has a certain amount of control, command in the bullpen, he's going to go to the mound, and he's kind of going to, he's going to have a better idea where the pitches are going to go and what they're going to do than he did probably at the start of the season.
Right. Gotcha. All right. Well, let's talk about the Lions and where they're going since the mm-hmm. start of the season. It just looked like they're just, I mean, this can't go on for an entire season, but it just looks like they're in total sync. They're 17-5 as we sit now. It can't go this way for an entire season.
They're going downhill right now. They haven't scored 9 runs for 2 straight games.
Yeah. So see, it's already started. But they had this today. They scored a run with 2 extra bases on 4 hits, or I'm sorry, after 4 pitches today. So they just look unstoppable mm-hmm. right now. They're pitching better than I think they expected to. But even then, they're not pitching that great. And I saw these numbers. They are their team ERA is 4.04, and the starters' ERA is 3.60, while the relievers' ERA is 5.03. So, and it doesn't matter. We're not even talking about how they're pitching. You know, they're over 4 with the ERA, and that the relief is not getting it done. But that's not a formula for winning against good teams, especially in the second half. And it just doesn't matter because they're...
I'm sorry. Why do you say that?
Why do I say that having a 4 ERA...
Well, I'm just saying you're throwing it out that having a 4 ERA is not going to help you win against good teams in the second half of the season. What's the basis of that analysis?
Well, when's the last time you saw a team that was giving up 4 runs a game win the championship? I don't remember any recently.
Well, I couldn't tell you offhand, but I was curious. It sounded like you knew, so.
Over 4. I'll go back and check as we talk here, but I don't remember teams going over 4 and giving up all of those runs and winning. But here's the deal: is they're scoring more than 6 a game, so you know they're leading in. Yeah, we'll go through some of this in mini tracks when we get to that segment, but they're leading Japan in OPS, and that's over 800 as a team. Their team OPS is over mm-hmm. 800, so that's crazy. You know, they're pitching better in some spots, and they're getting the better starting pitching than I expected them to have. And but I don't know, you know, I said last week, not sustainable. I just don't know how long this is going to go on. But when you're scoring, they had this record stretch of scoring at least 9 runs a game that ended the other night. It was Shuta Ishikawa of the Hawks stopped that streak.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing is today, the game that they won today over the Eagles, they pulled Yusei Kikuchi after 71 pitches in 6 innings in a 2-0 game. that was like not nearly in, they were not nearly as in control of it as maybe you would think. Of course, the Eagles have been struggling, and they haven't been able to score runs, and they hadn't scored in ages. I think Carlos Peguero, he homered in the eighth inning. That was their first run in 21 innings of play. But still, you know, they're now thinking long term. Not let's just get a pitcher through the game today, but let's get a guy through the season. They're doing the Alex Ramirez kind of let's look at the this thing in terms of the long road and get a guy out even when he's not tired. And Kikuchi said in the Hero interview today, he said, "Well, I'm gonna pitch on 5 days rest." So they wanted to get me out.
Oh, because they got nine games in a row, yeah. Right? Well, that sounds like a plan. So, I mean, that.
But I mean, the train is like slowing down here. They're starting to ration stuff out there. I mean, they're in cruise control already. That's how much
Maybe. Now, just as far as their pitching ain't any good, you know, it doesn't really.
I didn't say ain't any good. It doesn't matter. I said ERA over four. I mean.
Okay, I know that's. I'm sorry to paraphrase. Yeah,
the bullpen
that's
might not
weak.
Sound very good right now at five, but you know, 3.5 for starters. That's fair.
But yeah, the thing is, they have the highest percentage of quality starts in NPB the last 4 weeks, 62%. Mentioned all the offense stuff, so there's not really too much to be said about that. But no, I still like their defense. They do make a bunch of errors, but you know, I had a really nice chat with Hatsuko Tsuji about that, and I was really disappointed. Hadn't talked to him until then, and people had too warned me off him. You know, they say, you know, he's not very media friendly, but I'd always had a good connection with him when he was a Swallows coach and when he was a Dragons coach and coaching with the national team.
Right.
I always got just the best answers from him. And so I stopped him and I said, you know, sorry, I haven't talked to you for a year and a half since you become manager, but he was just really engaging. And we talked about the Lions defense and, you know, as really being the bedrock of this team. It's not the offense, it's the defense. Now, you know, having the offense is the other part of that, and I've mentioned this before, that's my preconception going into that I believe, you know, that's the way the Lions are built. But it was interesting, you know, basically he has theories about, you know, maintaining a lot of defensive, you know, very high level of fielding. And we talked specifically about Sosuke Genda as being a big part of that. And I said, you know, how much the errors bother you? He said, you can take all the errors and throw them in the pool. I could care less.
What I said the job in the preseason done. When someone asked us about him, I said, huh? Nah, man, errors? He's getting so many balls.
Yeah.
He's going to make a few errors.
Yeah, and he said, the way he's doing it, the way I want him to do it, which is never to worry about that, to always be trying to get to the next ball, never give up on a ball, always think you can get to every ball, and keep practicing. He has a theory about that, you know, you practice to get to the ball that's just out of reach.
Mm-hmm.
And you get that one and you just get better at it. You get better at handling those balls because you're used to doing it in practice. And I don't know if that applies or it's just, you know, a harebrained theory or what, but the Lions have been good at getting, making tough plays, you know, clutch catches. I mean, I look at Tonosaki and I just think, where does this guy, you know, where does he have that ball magnet? Where does he hide it in his glove when he's playing in the outfield?
Right.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, I'm looking through the books as we talk here. I haven't seen any teams that have been over 3.5 that have won the Pacific League title in the past 5 years.
Okay,
I'm still looking.
Okay, well, we'll address that next week. We'll just get. I'll have a okay. look. I don't want to waste any time of any of your time going through the books right now at this hour of the morning. But yeah, no, I'm I as I I it's not that I disagree with you. I just like, I'm just an enemy. It always makes my hair stand on end. What little hair I have left, you know, when somebody says, you can't win, you know, if you can't steal bases or any, I know I'm oversimplifying, and, you know, anybody says it's like Joe Morgan, you know, you can't win if you can't bunt. You can't win if you do this. You can't win if you do that. Well, yeah, sure you can. It's just that it's harder. You know, you can't hit if you don't, you know, it's like the Nippon Ham Fighters in 2006 and 2007 were, I believe, the only two teams in Japanese baseball history that won pennants while having the worst offense in the league.
Okay.
Okay.
But yeah,
you know, nobody does it, but it's not impossible.
Right.
You know, it's just unlikely. So, you can't win is kind of a tough one. But anyway, I mean, it may be true. I'm not saying it ain't true. I'm just saying those blanket generalizations drive me up the wall.
Yeah,
anyway, moving along.
I'd like to look at those numbers. I just haven't memorized them all, but I like to look at the numbers. What ERAs win in these leagues? And I haven't really I don't remember seeing a team over four. I don't know how far you'll have to look back to find one, but I think it's going to have it's
well,
gonna
now
be a while. So when you get to that next week, that'll be fun. So let's move along. The Lions, they're ridiculously good right now. They're really hot, and we might as well just go into mini tracks now. I think this is our first segment of mini tracks, making a smooth, seamless transition. I think the standings tell you what teams are hot and what teams are not. I'm just shocked at how good the Lions are and how bad the Eagles are, basically winning one game a week. They're 6-17 with a tie. They're already 11 games under 500. Remember, my magic number every year I talk about is 10. It's really hard to come back from that. But the good thing is it's still early. But they're already, they've got 17 losses while the Lions have 17 wins. And so this is going to be really hard for them to overcome. But it's not impossible. And they have a team that can do it. It's just that none of the guys, nobody.
Because they've got an ERA that's close to 3.5.
Well, that's not what I said.
I'm picking on you now, man.
You want to say that, but what are they? I mean, like I said, the Lions were averaging more than 6 runs a game. What are the Eagles averaging in terms of scoring?
Nothing. No, they got it. They're out buying runs from their insurance company.
And the insurance company is saying, what are you going to put up for collateral?
How about those bats
over there? They're not doing anything.
Hashtag high heat.
Nah, we're just being mean.
This comes on a day when
we saw a little shadow of 2017. We had Carlos Figueroa and Igor Imbogi homer in the same game. How common was that a year ago? It was like every 3 times a week we'd see one of these guys going deep, and it was like, who can stop the Eagles?
Yeah, just a year ago.
Wow.
What a difference, eh?
Indeed.
So indeed. They're bad, and then bad. They're not winning. They are not winning.
No, they're pretty. They're not winning for a reason. Their pitching, as you have pointed out, their pitching is adequate. Their starting pitching, in particular, their starting pitchers have the second best ERA in Japan. They stay in the game the second longest in Japan. How come that's not a surprise? Mm. But everything else is bad. You know, they're 11th in on-base percentage in NPB. They're 11th in slugging they're 11th in allowing teams to get on base. Okay, they're 12th in getting on base themselves. They're 11th in slug. Their relief pitcher's whip is 12th in out of 12 teams. So, yeah, that's kind of stinkeroo.
Trouble in River City.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. So, As you said, the standings pretty much tell the story. I have the Lions number one. The team I like the last right now, who's trending upwards, is the Yomiuri Giants.
Yeah. they've been beating up on the Dragons all season, so I'm not sure how much credit I'm going to give them. But they did catch a Dragons team that had beaten the Hiroshima Carp in a sweep at home, and they beat the brains out of them, including a 20-run game this past week, in which was 63 years it had been since they scored that many runs in a game. And they said not even the V9, the teams that won 9 consecutive Central League championships, had done that, had scored that many runs. So it was quite a thing.
Yeah, you had to go back. You had to go back to the era when there were teams in the league that really weren't good enough to compete. Mm. You know, and they didn't have enough pitchers, you know, and they threw a guy out there and, you know, just hold your nose and gut it out, baby. So the Giants are, interestingly enough, in the last 4 weeks, the Giants are the worst team in Japan in the percentage of quality starts.
Not a surprise.
But they're, yeah.
To me.
Considering they got such good pitchers. But Taguchi... Well, they had, you know, coming into the season, they had the two starters who had the best records, you know, the most effective starters in the league over the last 2 years, Kazuto Taguchi and Sugano, and they both got off to horrible starts. But since then, Shun Yamaguchi's come and pitched one good game after another. Sugano is now churning out one good game after another. Taguchi's finally gotten on board. You know, they've got decent starts from Kano Take. I mean, like, Kano Take, come on. Again, you know what's going on?
That was against the Dragons. I mean, you know.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Fair enough. But so the quality start percentage is really poor, but the relief pitching has been very solid. They're hitting the extra bases like crazy.
Right.
Their defense is adequate, so they're doing quite well right now. So those are the two teams I like. In addition to at the bottom of the barrel, I think because it's, you know, still early, we're just going to go with the top two and top the bottom. As we mentioned, the Lions are on top, the Eagles are on the bottom, and very close to 11th. Actually, there's probably three teams that are challengers for right now, worst in Japan.
Fighters a shout out.
Who?
The Fighters. I had picked them to finish last.
The Fighters, yeah.
They're winning some games. They should get a shout-out.
Yep, they are.
Shout-out to the Fighters.
I still... Yeah. Well, I mean, it's weird because, you know, normally you see most of the bad things are, you know, most of the teams at the top have all the good ratings, you know, and all the teams at the bottom tend to have most of the bad ones. But there's a lot of guys, you know, teams like the Bay Stars are really good at this and really bad at that, and the Swallows are the same, and... you know, the Hawks have some issues, like their starting pitcher's ERA is 4.05, which is 10th in Japan. Mm. So, you know, the Buffaloes are holding opponents. I talked about their pitching last week. They're holding opponents to a 300 on-base percentage, which is the best in Japan. You know, so it's just weird. But the teams, I guess, that are probably most consistently at the bottom are the Tigers, Dragons, and Eagles.
Yep. Yeah.
So those three are the kind of the weak sisters. The Carp are not. Yeah, they're gonna have. They've got some competition. You know, things have not been so rosy in Carp land. So it's gonna be interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, they're still again. Although Yoshihiro Maru went off the field today, and I thought it was a hyperextended knee or something, but. Someone said hamstring, so I was confused because I was watching the game and they showed a replay and you could see his leg bend kind of funny, so I don't know. You know, they said the injury they reported for Dennis Sarfate was something different from what he told me. So whatever they're reporting or whatever they're telling people, whatever. I don't know. We'll see. But I did want to give a shout out to a couple players. A few. Seiji Kobayashi of the Giants is just, you know, knocking the cover off the ball. He's the Central League's top hitter at the moment. And Kazuma Okamoto, a guy I really liked when the Giants drafted him. And as I tell people all the time, you never know when a guy's going to come along and the lights are going to go on. I didn't see it coming, but you know, he looks like he's here to stay, and he reminds me a lot of Akira Eto, just, you know, in the way that he swings and plays the game. So that's the comp I would use from years gone by. And then Shun Yamaguchi, you touched on him really quickly, but he's got two consecutive complete games in which he allowed a combined 3 runs, 8 hits, and has 23 strikeouts in that time. So the change for him to a starting pitcher, that switch has been good. And if he can not have off-field issues that he had last year that got him suspended, or whatever it was.
Yeah, it's funny, it seems like out of context for Yamaguchi, but I don't even remember this. So when he came to the Giants last year, he didn't have a complete game. And then I thought, well, when's the last time he had a complete game? It was like the last game of the 2016 season, when I think he had 6.
Wow.
So I remember he went through a string with the Bay Stars where he was one of the best pitchers in the league.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's just he had that weird season last year, and so he's back, and good for him. So a lot of interesting things. Even the Swallows are going through some bad times, but and I'm still not ready to say Yamada's back, because I've seen things, Tetsuya Yamada, I've seen things that make me think he's still not back, but he's showing encouraging signs.
Definitely.
And I love that. And if he does come back, that team is not a contender, because you can have the best. Well, other issues indeed. We'll just leave it at other issues.
Yes. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Making a 4-seam transition, we did lose another superstar from Japanese baseball this past week when Sachio Kinugasa died Monday. The reports started flowing in at our office on Tuesday afternoon, and he was the Iron Man of baseball, had the world record after he passed Lou Gehrig's record for consecutive games played, and he finished with 2,215 consecutive games played, and that remains a record. He played
in Japan.
Yeah. And, I saw the Kyoto story. I guess it was your story, and it had a picture that included the Kinugasa and Cal Ripken Jr. press conference that I think you and I were both at.
Did you see the picture?
You don't think you were there? I think you were there. I kind of have faint memories of you being there. But this is, again, probably around 2012 or so. And at that time, I asked both of those gentlemen why they hadn't become managers. That was my question to them. And they both essentially gave the same answer, which was they really had never received actual offers. And I thought, I guess you could manage wherever you wanted to if you just walked up and said, I want to be a manager. I don't know a team that would really say no. But I know...
especially the case in Japan where... it's not necessary that you actually have ever done anything to be a manager other than be a good player. Yeah.
So another great loss, and this is this is about 1 year after we lost Wayne Grassick, and I wanted to mention that last week on the show, and we ran out of time, but we're thinking about you, Wayne, still, and have these guys both leave us in the same month of April, and Kinugasa had been working. He had been doing color commentary on radios. He was scheduled to do a game on I think sometime this weekend, and I had just heard him, and actually my wife had heard him on TV and said, who's that? They sound really ill. And I said, that's the way Kinugasa always talks. That's the way his voice has been for a while.
He has that kind of, nasal voice. It was fairly distinctive.
Yeah, it's very distinguishable. I hear him on the radio, and I'm like, oh, I know who's doing the color on this radio broadcast, right away. But it did come as a shock. I mean, we keep saying that some of these people who pass away, Senichi Hoshino, seemed to come all of a sudden, and we didn't know, but they had been ill. And a lot of people knew, but I don't know anybody who really knew that Kinugasa was ill or this ill.
Other than people who were close to him. And,
right.
I feel really bad for Yamamoto, for Koji Yamamoto, because he was really close with both Kinugasa and with Seiichi Hoshino, especially Hoshino. And it's like, God, give this guy a break, you know? But I heard things. I was, you know, when I thought about, I was thinking about Yamamoto because I know reporters who covered him for much of his career, and I talked to him occasionally. And when we talk about, when you listen to him as a broadcast, I don't listen to analysts, I mean, you would have a better take on this than I mm-hmm. do. But when I talk to him in person about baseball, the answers he gives are grade A, bland, brand X.
Right.
You know, just the most boring stuff. And I asked other reporters, he's just boring. You know, he doesn't have anything interesting to say. But when he's talking about people,
mm-hmm.
you really feel, you know, you get the sense this guy actually has real feelings and very deep emotions and real attachment. Because he talked about things I read him saying about Kinugasa and the things he said about Hoshino at the Hall of Fame. A few months ago, you know, really touched me. And so I really feel sad for him. But yeah, Kinugasa was a great guy. He was very, very generous. And I was working on some stories a few years ago about the 1975 Carp, and he agreed to talk to me. And, you know, I'm really a nobody. And I remember people staring when he gave the interview at the dining hall at Tokyo Dome before a Giants game. And people were like looking, why is Kinugasa talking to that, you know, that foreigner? You know, he's a nobody. but they were all looking like, I don't know, like jealous because he was spending his time. But that's the guy he was. He just wouldn't, you know, he couldn't say no to anybody. I won't say he wouldn't say no because he was a professional, but he was very generous with his time and wisdom. And Mitsuo Tatsukawa, the battery coach for the Hawks, was a longtime Carp catcher, and he said something wonderful. He said when Kinugasa was playing third base for the Carp, he'd come out to the mound,
mm-hmm.
and he was kind of he was the guy who said what was what, and he said he spoke so clearly, and there were never any miscommunications. And mm-hmm. he never ever said a bad thing. He never heard him say a bad thing about anybody in his life.
Yeah.
So I miss him so much.
Yeah, I always say about these guys who play high volumes of games, it's not just, you know, because you can pencil their names into the lineups. It's because the guys produce. And obviously, Kinugasa had played with injuries. They made light of the fact that he had taken a hit by pitch or taken a ball off his shoulder when he was batting, and it broke a bone. And the next day, he appeared as a pinch hitter. And I saw something on TV where they said, you know, he struck out as a pinch hitter on three pitches. And he said the first swing was for the fans, and the second swing was for himself, and the third swing was for someone else. And I don't remember. I was half paying attention. But I mean, he's that's the kind of, you know, he wanted to appear. And, the first swing being for the fans. You know, this is not for me to appear in a game, but this is for you to see that I respect the game enough to come out and at least give it a try. You know, and so.
Well, he was something. And you know, the funny thing about him, and I've written about this to some degree, is that he's one of these guys who was basically a failure when he turned pro. Who was a catcher who couldn't catch.
Yeah.
Right. And he hurt his shoulder in camp, and he made it worse by trying to play through it. And he never really could throw. He never had that catcher's arm after that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is he had trouble catching balls catching breaking pitches, really good breaking pitches in the bullpen. And he said, you know, almost like I got a phobia about it, trying to catch Yoshiro Sotokoba. He was just trying to catch Yoshiro Sotokoba's forkball
mm-hmm.
in the bullpen. And I think in the bullpen at Hiroshima Shimin Kyujo used to be, the sun used to be in the catcher's eyes.
Oh, no.
It made him crazy. And I've been trying to get a hold of Sotokoba. I haven't got him to answer his phone recently since Kinugasa died. But I'm really curious to hear about that story. But yeah, no, and the guy who saved his career was, in addition to his ability to hit, was Riku Nemoto, who was a Hall of Famer as the front office guy who built up the Daiei Hawks, later the SoftBank Hawks, and also the Cebu Lions, and also the Hiroshima Carps. So really fascinating person, Mr. Kinugasa. And yeah, I'm just so lucky to have had a chance to meet you and talk with you.
Yeah, we will miss him. I'll certainly miss him on the radio broadcast. All right, a couple of notes before we get to the questions. One was I saw on TV, as of Tuesday's games, 120 games played throughout NPB. The replay system has been requested for use 50 times. I don't know if that's a lot it seems to me that the managers are showing a lot of restraint because they do have a limited number of times they can actually challenge a call. So they're exhibiting a little bit of restraint because there are a lot of close calls, but 40% of the requests, so the 50 requests, so 40% of those had been overturned. So that's a real poor percentage for the umpires, if you ask me. Of the close calls, they're only getting 40% of... I'm sorry, of the close calls that are challenged, they're only getting 40% of them correct. And there are a lot that go by that are not challenged. So I was actually having a discussion with one of my cousins, and I keep saying, hey, look, these calls don't make or break the games. They just change them. You've got to get an extra guy out in some instances. Sometimes it's a run scoring at the plate, so it's still that. But they're not making they're impacting the game for sure, but they're not changing the outcome all the time. And let's not make such a big deal. But if it's 40%, that's a big deal. That's a lot. No thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I think it is bad. But I think what it is they're going for sure things.
You say that, and I just say, and like I said, they're showing restraint. So I think there are other calls they want to challenge. And in fact, I think there were a couple games that I've seen. If some of the managers had challenged, they might have won. But they didn't want to use the challenge at the time. So, or the request, you can, you know, as you say, smooth jazz. But, so I don't know. Maybe they're going for the sure things and maybe they're not. There were a couple plays at first that were obviously safe. I don't even know how the umpires made the wrong call in the first place. So, it is scary how bad they are in the initial calls, and I think they're going to work to correct that. Let's get better at making the calls and so that they don't have so many overturned. But it doesn't seem, I heard someone complaining that the umpires don't want to overturn the calls, and I don't think that's the case. I think they actually want to get it right. But it is embarrassing for them, no doubt.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Well, they're the ones making the calls, so you can't blame it on New York, backing up their guys, and not being held accountable.
That's true. All right, players of the month. We're expecting it's going to be easy to pick this first players of the month. In the Pacific League, I think it's Hotaka Yamakawa, who's got more RBIs than games played, as the best hitter. And then Yusei Kikuchi, who won his fifth game. So he's the first left-hander in franchise history or in club history to win all five of his first five starts, whatever that says.
Find the Lions some more lefties is all I got to say.
And they have won 10 consecutive games to start the season, and that's a club record. And that they've extended, because I think they set the record at 9, so they've extended it, and we'll see how they do on Sunday. And they're playing games on Monday, so some of you might not hear this until Tuesday or Wednesday, because you'll be watching games on Monday. So we'll see how long that goes. But I don't remember what the longest record from the start of the season to win games at home is. I do remember that in 1999, the Dragons won 11 in a row to start that season, and they ended up winning the Central League and going to the Japan Series where they lost. So, so in the Central League, did you have any other guys that you had in the Pacific League?
Well, no, the Pacific League guys are pretty good. I don't have anybody else. I think the Central League, Randy Messenger is pretty much a shoe-in for pitcher of the month. Right. But the interesting one is, what are they going to do with the player of the month? Because they got one guy who's like the best player, and that's Yoshihiro Maru.
Right.
And then you've got guys that just have amazing numbers. And Yoshihiro Maru, because the thing is, one of the things that's amazing about him is the 34 walks, which is almost like twice. Now, I guess John told me it's 36 through Saturday, mm-hmm. Which is almost twice as many as anybody else in Japan has.
Walks count.
And here's the thing, of course. they can count if you can count them. But I think the people who do these, although having said that, there was a lot of, I'll say this politely, there was a lot of moaning and complaining about the way they picked their monthly MVPs, and they missed guys because they weren't on. Yusei Kikuchi should have been the MVP in July, but they had these candidates, and they were only going to name the people who were the candidates. And then at the end of the season, they started picking people who weren't candidates, because they were really good in the last week of the season, the last week of the month, excuse me. And so they changed the way it was done, but still one of the things they do is pretty much look at the guys who have the highest batting average or drive in the most runs or hit the most home runs. And Yoshihiro Maru is not really leading in any of those categories. So I think it's going to be a kind of a toss-up between Maru
among
and Kazuma Okamoto, yes, of the Giants, and Seiji Kobayashi of the Giants, who's leading the Central League in hitting,
yeah,
in batting average. So I think that's really going to be
– yeah, we'll be able to see what they value most. Ellipses.
Well, and here's the thing. Yeah, but here's the thing. It's like they'll pick, last year or 2 years ago, I watched as they picked somebody like Ryoichi Adachi because he had a high batting average and he had like 21 hits and 20 of them were singles. And he didn't draw a walk and he didn't drive in a run. And I'm going like, what is this guy doing? He wasn't scoring runs. He was like the worst offensive player. And Yohei Oshima had the exact same month.
Right.
And he won. And then all of a sudden, they started giving it to guys who actually deserved it. So, then they had another carbon copy. I think they do it. The Coca-Cola company has an award. It's called the Georgia Award, and the Georgia Award is it's got to be about the dumbest award imaginable, because instead of sponsoring an award, say like the best base dealer of the month, or the best base runner of the month, or the best fielder of the month, they have the award changes. So like in April, it's for like the best pinch hitter. And then in February, in May, it's for the best base runner. And then in June, it's for the guy, the guy who hits with runners in scoring position the most. It's like call it one thing. It changes from month to month.
It's like Coca-Cola, You have a big one of those big liter or 2 liter bottles in the refrigerator, and you open it up at the beginning of the week and it's nice and fizzy, and then slowly it starts to change and the fizz goes away and it just tastes like sweet brown stuff at the end of the week, right? Because you keep opening the bottle. So maybe that's what they're trying to simulate. That's it.
Of course, it's named after their canned coffee brand, so I don't know how that applies, but yeah.
So I think it's going to be Okamoto, and I'll tell you why, because he has all the sexy numbers. He has the runs batted in. He has the home runs. He's got a bunch of doubles. So I think he's going to get it, but who knows what these guys look at. Anyway, let's go to fielding questions. All right, so the first one is an MP3, and it comes from our buddy Mike in D.C.
Hey, guys. Here in the U.S., the early part of the baseball season is usually mired with terrible weather, like when it snowed here in early April. What's the worst weather you've sat through to watch a baseball game? Thanks, and keep up the great work.
All right, so he's asking about the worst weather conditions we've been in. So, you want to go first?
Yeah, the worst weather condition. I mean, I've first of all, I'm always inside. Yeah. I've been to some games. Yeah, I've seen some games that finished. You know, they called in a torrential downpour. Mm-hmm. But I guess the game I remember the most intriguing game was Game One of the 2005 Japan Series, which was called after five innings on account of fog.
The fog game, I remember that. I was at the office.
Indeed, yeah,
that's right.
That's right. Yeah, the year the Marines swept the Hanshin Tigers. Yep. Yeah, and it was I don't remember the final score, but that was a weird series. But anyway, so there was that one. But there's been games. I know. In fact, I know the first the Tokyo Dome when the Tokyo Dome opened the first game, somebody built a snowman outside because it was snowing.
Good grief!
But that's pretty rare in Japan. So that kind of weather for the end of March, early April. So.
Well, I can.
Well, I say it's rare for like the middle of April in Kansas City as well, but it was -8 degrees there 10 days ago.
Yeah,
we've
been seeing the weather as Mike said, just take its toll on the schedule in the major leagues. You know, I don't go to all that many games as a fan, but I have been as a fan since 2005, and I can tell you, any game at MetLife Dome or Seibu Dome, when it's 30 degrees Fahrenheit or about 3 Celsius, anything at that temperature or below, it's much worse and much colder inside that dome. And anything if it's 90 degrees Fahrenheit or about 27 degrees Celsius, anything above that, it's like a sauna in that place. So anytime you have extreme weather,
no. Like a sauna is not. No, it's not like a sauna.
Like a virgin,
it
right?
It is a sauna.
Yeah, there's no such thing.
Yeah, that's one of those ones. It's sort of like, yeah, like that, like a virgin. like there's kind of a halfway gray area there. No, it's a sauna.
Yeah,
it's sauna.
It's very uncomfortable.
Bring your towels. Yeah. Bring your towels very and enjoy the sweat.
But there are so many domes in the Pacific League. You got Seibu, Sapporo, Fukuoka, Kyocera. There are places you can go where even the fans get a break, but the outdoor stadiums, Jingu, Chiba, Sendai, Yokohama, Hiroshima, Koshien, they can have some extreme weather sometimes. I would say Hiroshima, Koshien being the hottest of all those places, and then Jingu can be really cold and has this nasty wind that whips up behind home plate. So, yeah, those are the areas. But basically, yeah, I have no bad experiences as a reporter because we usually sit in the nice cozy press box. All right, one question came to us actually about 10 days ago from Coaster Freak on Twitter, and he said, all PL teams have played a home game in Tokyo Dome. How does the financial situation work for all parties involved to put these games together and host there? Hashtag high heat.
I can't say I understand the arrangements with the teams and the stadium operators are a little more complicated. People I would know don't have access to them at the moment, and but I would say that the dome situation was kind of a weird one. It had to do with the company that owns Tokyo Dome being a business rival of the former owner of the Seibu Lions. The Lions have always drawn well since the days the Nippon Ham Fighters, when they were stationed at Tokyo Dome, and they would play home games against the Lions, and they would do really, really well, much better than the crowds at Seibu. And Seibu was always saying, you know, this is a pretty good thing. You know, when the Fighters left Tokyo to move, the Lions, the Pacific League had always been pushing, if you've got an open day, let's put the Lions there. We'll get more people. It's a win-win situation. But it was like the people who run Tokyo Dome were saying, we're not going to help anything to do with the Seibu Holdings.
Right.
We'd cut off our foot if we could. If you said we're gonna, you can cut off your toes if they're gonna lose a leg. They'd go, okay, let's do that.
Hashtag high heat.
We're good.
That's a good idea. We'll sign up for that.
I'm not kidding. So it was kind of that. There was a lot of spite there. But that whole regime's gone and buried, and so things are moving forward. But the thing is now, of course, that it didn't used to be like that, because the fighters were, they played most of their home games at Tokyo Dome, but now they play 7 or 8 a year, and there's a lot of open dates, and Oryx will come up and play a game every now and then, and the Hawks will have home games every year, usually one, sometimes two.
Right, the mandatory SoftBank game where they have all the employees fill the stadium, right? And wear the funky uniforms.
Yeah, and they give out a cheering kit, and then they get pennants, and they get pennants and jerseys and megaphones and all the towels and stuff, and and the Marines have home games, and the Eagles have home games. Everybody's got a home game. So as far as the financials, I can't really guess, but I do know that any team that plays in Tokyo Dome will have to get permission from both the Yomiuri Giants and the Yakult Swallows, because they both share the rights to Tokyo. You can't play there unless those teams say it's okay.
All right. Excellent questions. Thank you very much to Mike, and thank you very much, as always, to Coaster Freak. I've been calling him Coasty on Twitter there. He likes to note the no-hitters that are in progress, so that you can show everyone that this notion of not talking about a no-hitter doesn't impact the game. And I'm right with you there, Coasty. I believe it too, so it doesn't have any impact. I think he mentioned Shamsters early on in the impact, the no-hitter that Sean Manaea threw for the A's. He mentioned it early on, and he went on to finish it, so... anyway, thank you very much for the questions. We will be back next week, and we'll have a full week of games with all these games that are going on here during Golden Week, or Silver Days, whatever you want to call it. Enjoy your baseball.
See you at the ballpark.